President Obama has petitioned Congress for new authority to conduct military force against Islamic State militants. He's asking for a three-year authorization to fight them or their successors without regard for international borders. For what the president is requesting and not requesting, we turn to Nora Bensahel. She's a national defense expert and distinguished scholar in residence at American University. Nora, good morning and welcome back.
Good morning. Thank you.
On this snowy morning here. And so, you know, I've read this proposal and I've read what he's transmitted to Congress. And the president says, well, the 2001 authorization pretty much is what he needs, but he wants a replacement anyway. So what is your assessment of what he actually does want?
I think he does want a new authorization of military force. He's saying that he believes he has the authorities, partially because he's used that to justify the war on ISIS in Syria and in Iraq so far. But I think that the reason why he wants the new one is not that the old one doesn't give him the authorities. It's that it actually provides him with greater clarity about what Congress is authorizing. And frankly, it gets Congress involved in this debate. He wants Congress to have a stake in what's going on so that perhaps to dampen some criticism of his administration, but also because I think it's an important national conversation to have about what types of conflict the United States is going to be in.
And suppose, I mean, what would happen, for example, if Congress were to say, okay, you've got our cooperation and you've also got 200,000 ground troops that we want to go do this? That would kind of put them in a pickle, I think, of the administration.
That's right. I don't think that that's particularly likely. I don't think you'd see a majority in Congress supporting that. It's also not the kind of thing that Congress tends to do in legislation. I mean, you know, individual members of Congress, you know, express their opinions and talk to the administration regularly. But, things like that don't usually go into the legislation that authorizes the president to use military force.
All right. So what's going on now then? He has the authority to do under the old one, but could there be an element of wanting to end the old one because it's associated with the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and he doesn't like those?
No, I don't think that that's what's going on. He's made very clear that he's going to go ahead and use force against ISIS using those authorities without any problem. That, you know, his military action's been going on for many months now. I really do think that this is an attempt to get Congress involved in this debate, the American people involved in this debate, and to ensure that he has the authorities that he wants moving forward.
How do you think this fits into the bigger architecture of the president's national security strategy? Because I think in general, he has tried to argue that the kind of force that the United States is capable of bringing should be brought where there's a direct threat to the United States. And I guess, I mean, there have been Americans killed by ISIS only because they were close enough to the flypaper, if you will, to get stuck and you can't get out. So how does this fit into the bigger architecture, do you feel?
The president has made very clear that he will use military force exactly as you said when vital interests are at stake, and it's clear that the administration considers ISIS to be that kind of direct threat. Certainly, if it's allowed to grow unchecked, that's part of what the concern is, in addition to the heinous acts that they've already committed against Americans and citizens of other countries. So, you know, there's a great concern, and I think this is largely shared in Congress, about what this group could do if it's left unchecked.
And if he were to get what he wants from Congress, and I guess they're certainly going to debate it when they get back, how do you think that would change what the military is doing now, or would it?
I don't think it would change much about what the military is doing now. I think what's most interesting about the proposal, and we have to keep in mind this is just a proposal. Congress can approve it or, you know, change it however it wants. But I think the proposal strikes the right balance between breadth and depth. It doesn't contain any geographical limitations, which is something that is very important for the president moving forward, again, because of concerns that members of this group and people who have been fighting with it are going to spread out across the world. We've already seen some of that happening in the past few months. But also, you know, doesn't give him open-ended, unlimited powers. It explicitly in the proposal sunsets in 3 years. It will automatically expire, unlike the one that the authorization to use military force after 9/11. And so that means that it's not open-ended, that you know, Congress will have to debate this again. And I think that's a very notable combination.
And so getting to the point about geography, I guess maybe an analogy might be if you are a doctor who is trying to fight someone's cancer, then, and it starts in the liver, you wouldn't restrict yourself to other organs if that's where the cancer ends up spreading. I mean, you wouldn't restrain yourself from going elsewhere in the body to follow where the disease is.
Yeah, that's exactly right. That's a good analogy for what they're concerned about.
All right, so what do you think Congress, where will the debates be? I mean, some members have said that they don't like the idea of a 3-year limit because that signals to the enemy how long our commitment will last. And others have said, well, it doesn't go far enough in the sense of what it allows the president to do in terms of ground war. So could this end up in one of the stalemates similar to the ones we've seen over and over again?
I would never count out the possibility of a stalemate in this Congress. I do think that before submitting this proposal, the White House has certainly had many backroom conversations about what might be acceptable. I don't think that this is going to please everyone, exactly as you said, but I do think it may be enough of a reasonable compromise to be passed by Congress. The 3-year expiration simply means that Congress will have to reauthorize it in 3 years, that the debate will have to happen again. The onus would then be on Congress to pass another one if that's a concern. So there's nothing that says that the president, must stop everything in 3 years. It means that Congress will have to debate it again and decide what to do then. And there will be a new president at that time. The 3 years is not a randomly picked period of time. It's to give, after the election, a new president to come into office, get his or her bearings, and then decide in partnership with Congress what to do.
We're speaking with Nora Bensahel. She's a national defense expert and distinguished scholar in residence at American University. And so looking ahead at this, what should the military leadership be taking from it, do you think?
Well, one of the other really important and potentially controversial pieces of this proposal is that it says that the United States will not use, conduct enduring offensive ground combat. Those are the 4 words in the proposal. And I think that is exactly what that means. What does an enduring commitment mean? How many American personnel counts as enduring? It sounds strange, but what counts as combat even will be up for debate. Does that count advisors who go with units of local forces or not? So I think that the military will be looking to the debate for some clarification about that. But I think that in general, the way that the proposal is crafted, again, if it is passed as it's crafted, does give the military the flexibility to conduct the kinds of operations that it's conducting now. I don't think that there will be any great concerns that this will constrain their ability to do what they want to do, certainly for the next 3 years if it's adopted.
And I'm very reluctant to draw geohistorical analogies. But just hearing this on television a few days ago, I said to myself, that almost sounds like Lyndon Johnson. I mean, this is not going to be Vietnam, but yet it has that sound of saying we're just there to advise and just the only ground operations would be in direct protection of our own people and so forth. Could a thing like this grow without anybody's real planning for it to grow?
Well, it certainly could. The president's intent is not to fight with, large-scale ground combat forces the way that the United States has done in Iraq and Afghanistan most recently. The nature of the threat doesn't lend itself to those types of forces either in a way that, is a very, very different situation than Vietnam. When you're talking about, a relatively small but very, very deadly group of individuals, large ground units in combat on the ground is not likely to be the tool that you want to use from a purely military perspective anyway. You do want advisors. You do want the authority to conduct direct strikes using special forces or using drones, perhaps. But I think that the Vietnam analogy isn't quite right because the nature of the adversary is so very, very different here.
Good. I was hoping it wasn't quite right because we'd hate to see that happen again. And I guess in an ideal world, I'm making this up, but Egypt and Jordan and Saudi Arabia and the few semi-stable countries still left around there would take the big armies they have, and they would do the big ground, whatever is needed on the ground, with American advising and air power and drone support, which we uniquely have there. What do you think the chances of that actually happening are? I know Egypt has launched airstrikes and Jordan airstrikes, but they haven't really committed with feet.
Yeah, and I think that's likely to be the pattern. I think that's mostly what our allies in the region are going to provide. The big possible exception to that, I think, is Turkey, which has very direct interests in Syria, not just about ISIS, but in some ways even more so about what happens in Syria and the future of Bashar al-Assad, whether he falls or stays in power. And again, ISIS and what's going on in the civil war in Syria are related, certainly, but they're not the same thing. They are distinct in some ways. And so, Turkey's interest in getting involved with American cooperation, assistance, and I think they would like an American ground force presence as well. I'm not sure they'll get that, but that's what they would like, is much more related to the civil war in Syria than it is about fighting ISIS itself.
And also there's the issue of Iran, and they seem to be the ones taking over from Iraq almost, which makes them our ally, I guess, in some nominal sense. And so how can the political leadership deal with the issue of Iran helping us against ISIS, but doing everything else Iran usually does everywhere else?
That's certainly a challenge, but it's not unprecedented in a way. Iran was really very quietly behind the scenes, not publicly, working with the United States in Afghanistan in 2000. Well, I shouldn't say working with, but there was at least deconfliction of what the United States and Iran were doing in Afghanistan in a way that was very helpful for what the United States wanted to accomplish in 2001 and 2002 in particular. So when there are some common interests, it is possible to, have again, cooperation isn't the right word, but some amount of coordination and ensuring that the countries are not working at cross purposes. And I think that's the kind of thing you're likely to see here. ISIS is very much a threat that Iran feels as well. It has to do with Sunni extremism, which Iran is very concerned about as the major Shia power in the world. So, politics makes strange bedfellows, and so where there are some, small common interests, countries sometimes find a way to at least deconflict what they're doing in their common interest while continuing to be adversaries on many, many other issues, which certainly will be the case with Iran.
And back in Operation Desert Storm, there was an easily definable objective, get Iraq out of Kuwait, and that's what the coalition did, and it was pretty cut and dried. Arguments over how far it should have gone, will continue, I guess, as long as people debate these things. What is a possible definition of the end of ISIS or victory in this whole thing? The president says degrade and destroy. What does that mean, though?
That's a really good question, and it's very, very difficult to define when you're talking particularly about a non-state actor. I think what the goals of the operations are is to destroy enough of the leadership and contain where ISIS can operate geographically so that it no longer poses a major threat to the countries that it's in or countries in the region. That sounds all very nice, and I can say that very clearly. What that actually means in practice, of course, is going to be very difficult to determine. But that is the focus of the strategy, is to try to use intelligence methods wherever possible to understand what the group is doing and to try to disable it and disarm it in a lot of ways through not using military force. I think that's very important. There's also a lot of international financial cooperation to try to strangle the resources that ISIS has, which are quite considerable. But the military piece of that will be to target leadership and destroy assets that are valuable to the organization. And the goal is to work with local forces to help those local forces remove ISIS from the areas where it is, as we've seen happen with U.S. air power operating in conjunction with Kurdish forces in northern Iraq.
Nora Bensahel is a national defense expert and distinguished scholar in residence at American University. As always, thanks so much for joining me.
My pleasure. Thank you.